This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 91. It is late October 2014, and Chris Graham joins me today to talk about fermentation. I just finished up the How to Brew All Grain DVD with John Palmer, and they're actually shipping to my house right now. Should be available within the next week on Amazon. I'm really excited about this project. John and I jointly wrote the script, filmed over 3,500 video clips, and then distilled it down to a 90-minute video. This joins the 70-minute extract video we released earlier. Our goal is to make the best possible DVDs on homebrewing, and I think we succeeded. The extract video is available now, and I'll have the all-grain video available on Amazon, Amazon Instant, as well as Vimeo and many homebrew stores in just another week or so. You can learn more about these at beersmith.com/DVD. Also, I'd like to thank this week's sponsor, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're now offering a full 6 issues a year, up from 4 for the same discount price. In addition, you can get another 20% off your subscription when you use the offer code BEERSMITH at checkout. I encourage you to check out this great new magazine for homebrewers at beerandbrewing.com and use the offer code BEERSMITH to get your 20% discount. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com and use the offer code BEERSMITH to get a 20% discount. And now let's jump into this week's episode with Chris Graham. Today on the show, I'd like to welcome Mr. Chris Graham. Chris is the president of More Beer and More Flavor, Inc. at morebeer.com. He teaches brewing at the world-renowned Seibel Brewing Institute, and we've had Chris on the show 3 times before for podcast 1663 and a great tutorial on kegging in podcast number 79. It's great to have you back on the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
So how have you been? What's going on in your world?
Doing fantastic. Doing a lot of stuff with my kids as they get a little older. They're running around everywhere, so they keep me busy at home. And then at work, we're just growing and expanding as always.
You guys got two little ones, right?
We have twins who turn 2 in December.
Well, fantastic. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about fermentation equipment and the fermentation process. Let's start with the basics. Why is fermentation so important to the flavor of your beer?
Oh, geez. It's probably the key determinant of the ultimate flavor of your beer. If you think about it from a standpoint of, you know, there are different ways to make your wort before fermentation, and they can have their own flavor impacts. But all of that would be negated if you had very poor fermentation techniques. So fermentation creates most of the flavor profiles that you pick up in beer, one of them being alcohol, but the rest being esters, diacetyl, and a myriad of other flavors that are present in beer. And there's so many factors that determine what flavors are made in that process. The big things I want to talk about briefly are temperature, and we'll cover that a little bit later, but basically too hot, too cold are going to make all kinds of different flavors for you. And also sanitization and making sure we're clean, and that how much wild yeast and bacteria got into our wort pre-fermentation and had an effect on there. There's no such thing as none. It's limiting how much actually get there and influence the beer.
Well, before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about equipment. What most people start with something simple like a 5-gallon bucket. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of using a system like that?
I'm one of those people who started that way. And, you know, the advantages, one is cost. They're cheap. They're easy to get your hands on. And what's beautiful is most of us actually start with more like a 6, 6.5, maybe even 7-gallon bucket, because then you get some headspace. So you're going to reduce the mess that you make when using them, as opposed to if it was 5 during fermentation, we're going to have a croison, and that would be all over the place if you made a 5-gallon batch in them. So that's the huge advantage of them is cost, easy to lift. They're prevalent. The downside is longevity. Many times people talk about ooh, I've developed a smell. And I'm like, oh, if you can smell it, that's a bad thing. Unless it's just like a slight fermentation smell. Fruity ester usually is what you'd pick up. But any other smells are horrible. And also the fact that bacteria can set up in them a lot easier than other materials, mainly because those types of plastics aren't generally a high enough density to prevent scratching. And so on them over time, as you clean them, you'll usually see scratches forming. The way I usually see it is actually you'll see a little bubble line after you fill it with water. And meaning that that's where you have scratches going on. It's hard to sanitize in those areas. And over time, people usually use them, you know, I've had customers use them 20, 25 batches without issue. But after that, they're like, ooh, that last batch didn't taste like it should have. And, you know, concerns over it, just either to replace it with another one or move to either another material or a harder plastic in the form of some of the plastic carboys. We'll talk about those. But those are usually what people transition to.
So, Chris, most people then move on to a glass or plastic carboy. What are the advantages and disadvantages of that?
All right. Well, plastic carboys are the new kids on the block, relative speaking to carboys. So let's start with glass first. The number one concern with glass is safety. Many have broken over the years, whether it's in use or in storage or mostly when being cleaned or moved around. This can be negated a little bit by using carboy haulers. Usually these are nylon webbing strappings to help pick up the carboy. And they also act as a little buffer when you go to set it down. So instead of setting the glass on, say, concrete, you're setting it on nylon, which helps reduce the impact. The other way people set up their glass carboys is with a handle on the neck of the carboy. Those are super handy for handling empty carboys, but as a warning, I do not recommend trying to pick up a full carboy with them. I've literally seen them snap off. I use them to help tilt my carboy, let's say, during racking.
Take a picture of one there, yeah.
Exactly. So that handle is perfect to help tilt it, or when it's empty, to help move it around. But when it's full, make sure you're lifting from the bottom of the carboy as opposed to just one point on it. Now, from a material, glass is fantastic. Easy to clean, easy to see through, hard to scratch. So its longevity is great. It's also very not oxygen permeable. So for long-term storage of liquids, let's say a big barley wine or something, you don't have as much fear as oxygen having an impact on the wort itself. But from a damage standpoint, it has its concerns. Plastic, the carboys that are coming out in plastic are mostly all PET, which is a different type of plastic than, say, your bucket would be. It's a much higher density, harder to scratch plastic. Think 2-liter bottle of soda. So some of the cool things that I love about plastic is, one, the oxygen permeability is not that bad. For most of us beer makers, it's great. Wine, it's actually fantastic in the tests we've done and others have done on it. But people's concern is that oxygen would permeate, and it does more than glass, but it's not a whole lot. But the real question is longevity, cleaning, hazing, that kind of stuff. So it really depends on how you handle them to how long they'll last. I don't recommend carboy brushes for plastic carboys. And most people, once they use them once, realize they don't need them. Any kind of cleaner, any kind of oxidizer type cleaner, the straight A's, the one steps, the PBWs, you use a little bit of that. And just by the fact of how slick that material is, most of your croizen falls right off after soaking for a half hour or so. So that's kind of the difference. And they both come in a bunch of different sizes, which makes them handy. And we'll talk about secondary fermentation, but as a primary fermentation bucket carboy, always think more than your batch. So in a glass or plastic carboy, I want at least 6 gallons for 5-gallon batches.
So Chris, it might be a good time to talk about sanitation. What are the key points of sanitation with fermentation?
So the big thing to remember is you can't sanitize something that's dirty. So before we even talk sanitization, let's talk cleaning. And that's in anything, but most important, your fermenter, because this is where you're going to put your freshly made, vulnerable, I say vulnerable to bacteria and wild yeast, wort to sit down for a few weeks for fermentation. And so if it's not clean, we're going to have all kinds of problems right from the get-go. So cleaning, basically, the nice thing about most of these materials is you can see it. And if you can see debris, you got to keep cleaning. So my personal favorite cleaner is PBW, but I've used anything from OxyClean to Straight A to One Step, and they're all good cleaners. Most of them need to be rinsed afterwards. I think One Step, you don't need to rinse afterwards, but I do because I'm going to sanitize it anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But basically, warm liquid with an oxidizer, warm liquid with PBW, a little soak, most of that solids break down enough that if it's in a glass carboy, I still usually have to use a brush, but not for more than maybe 5 minutes or so to make sure it's good and broken down, a quick rinse, and then we'll go into sanitization. Mm-hmm. And on the PBW or cleaning, I don't really care how full or empty you do it. I'm the type where PBW is not that expensive, so I usually come close to filling my vessel up when doing the cleaning. And I also usually clean many things at once. And as long as what I was cleaning in the beginning wasn't too dirty, I can then clean the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. I keg, we did that discussion before. So sometimes when I'm cleaning my carboys or my conicals, I'll take that cleaning liquid and then clean kegs with them too. Because as long as I haven't really soiled the water too much, that I'm usually good to keep using that cleaner the same day. Now we've rinsed and we go to sanitization. That I am a strong believer in full liquid fill pour sanitization. I'm a Star San user. I used to use iodophor. I've used other sanitizers as well. I like sanitizers that are no rinse and you don't have to drain 100% to not fear them. So Star San works really well for me. I don't fear the foam. I've tasted it in the dilute format. It doesn't add character to your beer. It doesn't kill yeast at that dilution level. Plus, by the time you put your wort on top of it. So anyway, I say it's mandatory to do the full volume. Don't try to put 1 gallon of sanitizer and really try to distribute it. The pros can get away with it in conicals, but they're using much more aggressive cleaners and sanitizers than we are as home people. All the stuff we use at home, if it touches our hands, it doesn't burn the skin off. So it's quite safe, but yet need for that in mind, it needs a little more contact to really be effective. Mm-hmm. So that's my little spiel on making sure, one, you can't sanitize dirt, and two, when you do sanitize, you want to do at least 5 gallons in your 6.5 gallon carboy.
Yeah, so there's PBW and Star San from Five Star Chemicals, which is actually what I've been using lately, too.
Yeah, you know, it just works, and a lot of breweries use it as well, and I've been using it for 10 years without issue.
Cool. Well, I wanted to go on to the next option, which for fermenters, which is a conical fermenter. And most pro brewers use a conical fermenter. Why is that?
You know, one of the biggest advantages of a conical fermenter in a pro environment is the time of fermentation. And I know that doesn't sound like the biggest advantage because, yes, material that we weld them out of stainless. And, you know, stainless is a great material for repeated use. It's food grade, it's resistant to staining and rusting and all of that. So it's a perfect material for repeated use without any impact on the final flavors. But one of the things that most people don't understand of what makes a conical uniquely different is the 60 degree cone on the bottom and what's called tank hydraulics, which is what the fermentation cycle is doing inside of your wort and how quickly you're getting yeast exposed to the sugars and how thoroughly you're doing it. So if you sit and watch your plastic or glass carboy fermentation. And I love new brewers because that's one of the most fascinating things to actually watch the, you can actually see the movement going on inside of them.
Yeah, and a light beer, you can see it churn. It's just amazing.
Exactly. You can even see big clumps of the trub get lifted by the CO2 being produced and rising to the top and the way that it flows. Well, in a conical, what they find is usually they build, it makes like a column up the center and then down on the sides, which makes this great churning effect. And they can actually, if you go to like an anchor brewery or somewhere where they're using on purpose non-conical shaped fermenters and then do the same wort, same yeast in a conical, a lot of times they'll find most of the processes are done faster. So that's one of the best, biggest advantages. Then you have a lot of other things that come from that conical on the bottom. The separation of trub is so much easier when you could just pull from the bottom. So if you're a big brewery, you can help get that out and then be able to get access to your yeast as it settles out on the bottom. So those are also two tremendous advantages of having the cone and the port at the bottom of those fermenters.
So you have the ability to separate the wort from the yeast without necessarily transferring it, right?
Exactly, which introduces a lot less risk on the beer. We'll talk in a little bit about secondaries and why they can be a good thing or why they can be a bad thing. But one of the things is when separating, in this scenario, you're just removing the solids out of the bottom, not moving all the liquid from one vessel to the other, which makes a lot less introduction of any negative airborne yeast bacteria into the wort.
Well, let's talk about that for just a minute. What about doing a secondary? Is it worth moving to a secondary? Is it too much risk? Some people have said that you don't really need a secondary. You can now just ferment in one vessel.
Well, I'm going to give you the White Labs answer, which is it depends. Which is always my favorite answer. But it really does. It depends on what kind of beer you're making. So the general rule of thumb is basic ales, and I'm talking pale ale, porter, stouts, IPAs, anything, let's say, under probably a 1070 to 1075 starting gravity, doesn't, in my opinion, need a secondary fermenter. Mm-hmm. Or fermentation process to go on. That word is kind of misused because we're not introducing more sugars. We're not introducing anything new to the wort. We're just separating it. So it got coined secondary a long time ago, and most of us still use that word. But a true secondary would be is actually when we're going to reintroduce more sugars to do something with that wort. Post the initial fermentation.
Yeah, I think most of us do a secondary just to separate the wort from the yeast, right?
Exactly.
And at the homebrewer level.
I was going to say, to separate trub and yeast. And most of us see how much trub is settling in our carboy, and we're like, ooh, I got to get it off of there. That's going to make better flavors. And when I started brewing, you know, more is better. So I used to do not only one separation, sometimes I would do two. And thinking I'm making a better beer. There was a great experiment in the 90s at a brewery in Eugene, Oregon called the Wild Duck. They're no longer in business, but they did an awesome experiment testing a few different things, and that was one of them. Some of the other things they were testing was a large carboy versus a small carboy to see if blow off is better to stay in or to go out. A lot of people think the croissant in a wort would lead to bitterness, and so they tested that. But the big thing they tested was single fermentation, same wort, versus moving it. And the experiment they did was really well done because it was one big batch going into a bunch of carboys in the same exact environment, as opposed to a lot of experiments. Oh, I made the same batch three times in a row. Well, those of us who have brewed enough know that it's almost impossible in a home level to replicate the exact same wort three times in a row.
Oh no, all my beers come out exactly the same.
Nice one, Brad. I would love to say that. And it's actually maybe a great experiment. It's a great experiment to do. In fact, you'll become a better brewer trying to make the exact same to the specs wort three times in a row. You'll learn a lot about your brewing techniques and practices, but long story short, they separated it Then they had a bunch of judges come in blind tasting all these different experiments they did of the exact same wort. And what really came apparent quick was, one, they found that intentionally getting a blow off actually hindered the flavors instead of helped them. So meaning if you did a 5-gallon carboy, so that all of your Kroisen left during the fermentation, they found didn't have as good a results as doing a 6.5-gallon carboy and letting the Kroisen come up and then settle back down into the wort.
Yeah, that's a so-called Burden on Trent blow-off method, I think is what it's called.
Exactly. And I think they usually use that for top cropping and harvesting and such. And then the second facet they found was most people preferred the beer that didn't go through a racking process than did. And I think the explanation is quite simple. I don't really believe they had a yeast or wild yeast or bacteria issue at the brewery. I think they were really good. Their grain room was separate, all of these proper techniques. It's the introduction of oxygen, degrading the beer. I mean, think about it. Like if you opened your favorite bottle of beer, let it sit long periods of time before drinking it. We don't do that for a number of reasons, but one of them is the oxidation that it'll go through. And in most scenarios, unless you're back flushing with inert gases and such, when you're racking into this other carboy, it's full of oxygen. And all that oxygen is stirring up in your and being absorbed into your wort post-fermentation. So now the yeast isn't there to absorb the oxygen anymore. And you're basically oxidizing your beer at that point. So I think that's the number one issue. And then number two issue is, you know, if you have any kinds of bacteria, which is present everywhere, introducing it has a chance to spoil the wort even further.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So long story short, I will say this. Long story short, all your basic IPAs and such, the way I teach brewing is I used to teach it 14 days, 10 to 14 days, one fermenter and going into your packaging, whether it be bottling bucket or kegging. If you're high gravity ale, you might want to do them one more secondary because you need more time to finish aging or even fermenting. And lagers, I almost always do a transfer because my process is slowed due to the cool fermentation process. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's switch gears now and talk a little bit about process. Strong fermentation starts with a lot of yeast, right? What are your thoughts on yeast?
Yeast is fantastic. You need it. So yeast starters, is good, huh? Yeast is good. Yeast starters is something we preach quite a bit for two reasons. One, it helps grow your yeast quantities, especially the viable cells. And two, it proofs your yeast to, one, make them stronger before they're about to do this work. And two, a lot of things can happen between when you get the yeast and when it was actually produced. So the yeasts are produced in labs and, you know, there's actually a few of them now in the country, but there's one in San Diego, one in Portland, Oregon, and now there's starting to become ones here in the Bay Area, ones in the East Coast. So they're made there. Then they sit on shelves for who knows how much time, probably not much, but then they're shipped to a distributor or the retailer. And then you either pick them up at the retail store or they're shipped to you. So there's a lot of handling that goes on that if the yeast had its perfect environment, it would just stay at one temperature and never shift. And that would make it the strongest when you go to use it. But all these factors that are both out of your control.
Well, the yeast ages over time too. The viability goes down because yeast cells don't last forever.
Exactly. And you'll see expiration dates and such. And, you know, and starters are a perfect example of, I've taken many expired yeast packets and still brewed with them by doing a starter because they don't expire because they're like milk and they turn and go bad. The viability goes down. Yeast cells die.
Generally, I think most packages, they quote about a 50, when it reaches about a 50% viability, they usually say it's expired at that point.
Exactly. So doing a yeast starter will help bring you back up to an acceptable range and reuse it. And I don't like to throw things away. So that's a lot of times what I brew with. So I like yeast starters from that standpoint. However, there are times where I don't have time to do them. And I kind of have a rule of thumb about where my gravity is going to be to how much I pitch, whether it be Y yeast or White Labs or dry yeast. Dry yeast is a big pitch. So I don't typically ever double pitch dry yeast.
I should point out, we're not really talking about starters in most cases for dry yeast, right?
Exactly. You can do proofing. Much like you would do bread, warm water, let them sit. I prefer to do that personally if I am going to use dry yeast.
I usually hydrate it maybe 20, 30 minutes before I brew. I'll hydrate the yeast in a little warm water. That helps.
Exactly. Exactly. Usually you'll see a much faster lead time.
But with liquid yeast, you're looking at doing a starter, right?
Doing a starter and doing it more than 2 hours before brew day, usually 24 hours at minimum, 48, sometimes even 72. Sometimes I even ramp up multiple starters, because what starters allow you to do is to take one vial or slat pack of yeast and build it up enough to be able to pitch into 10 gallons or even more, depending on what the gravity. But then there are times where I double pitch. If I'm going to do a 1065 or a greater beer and I don't have time to do a starter, I'll just pitch two yeasts into there with great success. Now, you don't want to do that on a mild, but because there is such thing as over pitching. Where you don't have enough sugar for the yeast to consume. I'm not going to go into the details because, one, I'm not that smart.
You usually have to have a lot of yeast to over pitch, really.
Exactly. But what sometimes, the long or the short there is, sometimes they basically don't do a proper job because you have too much yeast. You can under pitch, which is a very dangerous thing because you're in a competition right now to beat out the bacteria and wild yeast that are present in your wort. And it's there. Don't tell me it's not. It's there. It's just what level it's there. You want to keep it as low as possible and have bunch
of yeast. I don't have any bacteria in my beer. Yeah,
I love you, Brad. You must be one of the best brewers out there.
No. Not even close.
A HEPA room environment for your brew day. That's perfect.
Occasionally I get a good batch. It's not often, though.
Oh, I know you make good beer. I don't doubt that. But we all do. Even pro breweries have a certain amount in there. They have ways of reducing it tremendously. But it's all about a competition of yeast versus anything else. So good healthy pitch. A good friend of mine, Jamil, a long time ago, wrote a very basic software. He and John Palmer wrote Chris White wrote,
I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Well, they wrote the yeast book together.
Yeast book. Great yeast book. But even before that, he wrote a simple little app that you can use at MrMulti.com. I'll give him a plug there. Right. And it's just a pitching calculator. And it really helps dumb it down. What type of starter do you need to make based off of what gravity beer and how much volume you're making? And it really dumbs down the process nicely. I apologize if that's built in the Beersmith.
I have a tool for yeast starters in Beersmith as well. So you can use either. On, they're very similar.
Excellent. So there are new ways that I wasn't even aware of, and I do use Beersmith, but I'm a pretty light user. I use it for recipe formulation and brew day maintenance. I'm not a power user by any standpoint. Cool. But long story short, it helps dumb down the process, which is the key thing for me. Is don't fear this yeast thing. It when in doubt, I pitch two yeasts and I know I'm going to make a good beer. But making a starter is very simple and easy to do.
So don't fear the foam. Don't fear the yeast, right?
Exactly. But make sure you pitch enough of it.
Well, I wanted to talk next about oxygen, which is also very important for fermentation. And there's a good and a bad to oxygen. Obviously, you want a lot up front, but you don't really want any after that, right?
Exactly. Yeast need oxygen. So think of it as, when I'm going to put my yeast in, I need oxygen for them to survive. But once my fermentation is done, I no longer need that.
And I'll point out, we just finished boiling all that wort, so we took all the oxygen that was in it and basically forced it out in the boil.
When you see all the little spritey bubbling going on, that is oxygen in your liquid leaving. So there are three common ways of getting quote unquote oxygen into your wort. Let's talk the pro brewer way. And that is typically pure O2, bottled oxygen, compressed gas. And the reason I think it's the most common is it's easy to acquire. it's consistent, and you don't have to use it for very long. Most of us, when we put it in, the smaller the bubble, the more likely it is to be absorbed. So during your cooling process, that's a key factor, is having this cool wort to be able to let the oxygen be absorbed into it before the yeast is added. So think of it much like a carbonation chart. The warmer it is, the less oxygen is going to go in. So it's there's some rules of thumb. If you can get your wort into the 70s or even 60s, that's fantastic. And the cooler you can get it, technically, the less yeast, the less O2 you need in there. So in a pure oxygen scenario, if I can get my wort into the high 60s for an ale, I'll usually run 30 to 45 seconds of oxygen going through a 0.5 micron stone at a fairly slow rate. If I see it roaring, you know, big bubbles coming out.
That's an important point. I think if you're working with, you know, if you have the equipment to do pure oxygen, you only need to do it for maybe 30 to 45 seconds. It's not very long.
Exactly. And I don't really worry about over oxygenating in a homebrew level, because we're not working under pressure. We're not sealed tanks, and thusly you got to worry about putting too much O2 in there. But the law of diminishing return happens pretty quick, that you could put in 5 minutes worth, but probably not going to get anything more than 45 seconds worth. So O2 does cost. So most of us use those little home tanks for brazing and such that you can get at any hardware store. Most homebrew shops sell very simple kits. You buy the tanks locally, because no one should be shipping these oxygen kits because they're explosive. And thusly, one of those tanks, if you only use it that, you know, 30 to 45 seconds per 5 gallons, you're going to use that tank 20 times probably before it's empty. So it's a pretty good value. And you know, you're getting pure O2. The oxygen systems we sell, we put a little inline HEPA filter in there just in case there was any oils or whatnot, because they don't treat those like medical oxygen tanks in their preparation to fill. But it's the same O2 that they put in a medical one versus a welding one. But it's the way the tanks are treated beforehand that I worry about. So a simple little air filter will help remove any impurities that might come through.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the medical oxygen is a controlled substance, so you can't just, at least here in the U.S., you can't just go buy it. But.
Exactly, and if you get it from, don't tell me how you got it, you also you need very expensive regulators and such to be able to use them, and not usually worth the cost to do those things. So that's the pro level. I'm not going to go into inline versus a stone. Well, let's just stone at the bottom of the carboy. Let's just leave it at the bottom there. Maybe later we can circle back to an advanced techniques and we'll talk about that. But for the most part, that's pure oxygen. Then there's aeration, which is very similar concept. You use a stone again, aeration, and usually you use a small air pump. There you go. There exactly.
Got one up on the screen here.
Yep. And just a nice simple way to get it to go through. Now, keep in mind, the air we breathe isn't 100% oxygen. In fact, it's mostly nitrogen. So the times you need to go are tremendously longer. 30 minutes is what I usually hear. Some people go an hour. It's up to you. Again, law of diminishing returns. But you're going all this time with that running, and you have to use usually a 2 micron stone instead of a 0.5, because it's harder to push through those little 0.5 microns. You need to build a lot of pressure. So thusly, it's a bigger bubble. So it doesn't absorb into the liquid as easily. And you're just running it for this long period of time. So not my favorite, but inexpensive. And guess what?
Yeah, I mean, basically you're talking an aquarium pump, a little filter and a stone at the bottom, right?
Exactly. My biggest fear with that is how much time it's sitting in my wort and what can be happening in that time frame. That's part of my lag time. And so I like to keep the lag time, the time between cooling my wort and my yeast actively going, the dream is to get that as small as possible, because the less time there, the less things can go wrong. So the more I'm doing things like having this thing dangling in, not sealing the top properly, you know, I'll use tin foil so stuff can't fall in, but for the most part, I like to go faster. But if I'm not wanting to do O2 or the cost of it, I would definitely go aeration over the last one, which is generally either splashing or shaking. And that's what a lot of people do in the beginning. And I understand it. And I've made plenty of good beer in the beginning of my brewing that I didn't do any kind of oxygen add, and I still was able to make good beer.
So basically you're picking up the carboy and shaking it, right?
Well, the first thing a lot of people do is when they're pouring or draining their boil kettle into their carboy, they're letting it splash as much as possible. So that's the first thing they usually do, picking up the oxygen that's in the air that is splashing through. Now keep in mind, all the wild yeast and bacteria are also in that same air. And then the other thing people do, and I don't like this at all, is shaking the carboy, which you just mentioned, especially those glass ones. When do you think you hear most of people breaking a glass carboy is when they're trying to shake it. So by far my least favorite way of doing it. I would rather you do a little splashing in the pouring process than to pick up the carboy and shake it. But keep in mind, it's not even filtered air at this point. It's just whatever is in your air, which we have bacteria and wild yeast everywhere in the world. So it's there. So trying to reduce that. So
you want to mix that up, bacteria and wild yeast in then, right?
Well, that is coming in. So we want to keep that down as much as possible. Yeah. It's the enemy, Brad.
Well, the temperature for fermentation is also critically important. So I was wondering if you could say a few words about temperature and temperature control.
It's hugely important. I'll go back to a statement I made in the beginning. You can do everything technically sound, and if you don't have temp control, your beer can suck. So you can be an all-grain brewer. You can do every temperature to the nano perfection. But if you ferment your ale at 75 degrees or even more, that is terrible. So what isn't really the best fermentation room is the room that room always stays at 70 degrees, so it's perfect. I did that for a long time. And keep in mind, when I'm talking these little differences, I'm talking good to great. Yes, you can make good beer in just a room that holds a steady temperature, but making repeatable great beer, really you want that temp control. Fermentation itself creates heat. All that mechanical moving creates a lot more heat than most people think. I've done temperature experiments where I've temp controlled the room and then put sensors in the fermentation and seen 10 to 12 degree swings above the ambient temperature in the core of that fermentation. So that 70 degree room,
especially once it gets going, right?
Exactly. When you're really ripping, when you have that high Croissant on top of that fermentation, I've seen 10 degree differentials, meaning that 70 degree room was making beer ferment at, or was the beer was fermenting at 80 degrees. At 80 degrees, you're making fusel alcohols. Those are what give you headaches. They taste terrible. Those are the ones that when you go to a conference and someone gives you a beer that you're thinking, oh my God, this has to be 30% alcohol and it's only 8. That's that flavor right there. And generally, that means somebody doesn't have that ability. So temp control, how to do it. On the cheap, the best way to do it is through trying to submerse your fermentation vessel, bucket, carboy, whatever, into, my favorite is just into a bucket of water that I can put ice cubes into or blocks of ice. That's the easiest, in my opinion. I have a temp sensor on there. Now you have this huge amount of cooling power helping you keep that temperature of your wort. Now you have to check it frequently, especially during the peak fermentation, at least once a day, depending on how much liquid you use in there. Other ways of doing it, if you're like, hey, I don't have a tub that big to do that, you can do wet towels on top. That wicking action.
I use that quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, and if you want to add to that an oscillating fan, helps quite a bit too, to help that wicking process. And I've seen people hold 10 to 12 degrees under the ambient temperature when doing, you know, a repeated change of the wet towels or t-shirts or whatnot.
Yeah, the only problem is you got to change towels every 12 hours or so.
Exactly. So all those ways I've mentioned, ice and water and that, they're inexpensive, but they require you being present and making sure you're doing, changing out things. For those of us who are a lot lazier and want to kind of set it and forget it, temp controllers are your best friend on a chest freezer, an old fridge, something of that nature, to be able to dial in the temperature. I love the ones that I can both have a hot and a cold. And then I've covered my bases everywhere, and to make either the chamber, chest freezer, or fridge, or God forbid, we sell these temp controlled conicals that will just hold you right at the temperature you want to be at, without having to control something else.
Can you talk for a minute about why you need a temp controller, even on a regular fridge? A lot of people don't know that it's good to have this separate temp controller.
So a refrigerator itself is really designed to keep food safe temperatures, which are much cooler than what we need for fermentation, even lagers. So the first thing is they're usually ranges of temperatures that they'll hold. They're not terribly precise because they just want to hold you in this range of food safety, where we want to hold, let's say an ale, let's say I want to be roughly 68 degrees. I want to be able to dial that in and be within a 4 degree swing of that, as opposed to, you know, or 4 degree different, not differential, 2 degree differential. So I can go as low as 66 and as much as 70, or a digital one, I can even dial that down to be within a 1 degree differential. And I like the analogs and the digitals. I think they work equally as well. But having that ability, then when you play with different yeast strains, you can actually control them much more finitely, so that you can really enhance what flavors they do at different temperatures. The last little bit I'll talk about controllers is where you put that on the fermenter makes a huge difference, huge impact. So a lot of people used to put a jar of water in their chamber. I'm going to use a chest freezer, for example, and put the temp controller in the jar of water. And that is better than the air, because the air will change temperatures quite quickly, but the water doesn't. And that is a improvement over doing it in air. The problem there is that it's not the temperature of the fermentation, it's the temperature of the liquid and how much liquid and how fast that changes. So if you can get a sensor into the ferment, sanitary, you've got the best of all worlds. You're controlling the actual fermentation temperature as opposed to the air or a separate thing of liquid. So you're really knowing what your temp is. So there are thermal wells, and you can do them in carboys and buckets and conicals, which really give you much better control of your temperature during fermentation.
Excellent. Well, I was wondering if you could talk for a minute about other tips for fermentation, controlling temperature, raising temperature for various rests and so on.
Yeah, so essentially we'll separate ale and lager fermentations because they're quite different and different temperatures. So typical ales, I want to be somewhere in the 68-70 degree range, usually the 68 temp range. And I'm typically going to try to do, the most important is those first few days of fermentation, because that's where you're producing all that flavor. That's where the bulk of temperature of flavor impact comes into play in fermentation. So I'm going to do those on the low side, of my temperature range that I want to hold. And then as fermentation finishes out, I can kind of cheat it to a higher side if I want to help finish that fermentation faster. Now, I'm not talking going up to 80 or 90 degrees. I'm just talking a few degrees of play help speed things up. So my typical ale...
I assume you wait until active fermentation is done before you consider raising the temperature, right?
Absolutely. And I say raise the temperature. Again, I'm talking a degree or two. I'm not talking huge. Now, diacetyl, we will do something different, and we'll do that on a lager fermentation. But on an ale, just very slightly, if at all. And you don't need to do a raise at all in your ale temperature. But when you're done and you've tested, and we'll talk about that in a second, your fermentation is over. And usually for me, this is somewhere in like day 7 to 10, I will consider doing cold crashing. If I'm kegging my beer, if I'm bottling, I cannot do a cold crashing. I need my yeast in suspension. But if I'm going to keg it, I'll do that cold crash. And that helps go a bunch of different processes happen, as well as mechanically.
Talk for a minute about what cold crashing actually is.
So cold crashing is bringing the temperature down below 40 degrees in the fermentation chamber, fermenter, and a couple things will happen. If you've heard of chill haze, that is one of the, or cold crash, that is one of those processes where a protein haze comes apparent in this cold temperatures, coagulates enough that it'll fall out of suspension. And the nice thing is then if you do that in your fermenter, most of the time you can leave that behind and not bring any of that into your kegging process. So making much clearer, cleaner beer, or leaving behind all that trub, so you get clearer beer in your kegs and less sediment, less things to worry about, less things to move around when kegging. But again, that's on ales and only when kegging. Switching over to lagers, there you'll do your fermentation at much cooler temperatures, but then typically at those cooler temperatures you're not making any esters, but what you will find is quite a bit of diacetyl production, so you can get a reabsorption of diacetyl post that initial fermentation by raising your temperature up into the low 60s, letting the yeast absorb that diacetyl before bringing it back down, either for bottling or cold crashing if you're going to go into kegging. And that cold crashing is the exact same if you're going to do kegging.
How do you know when the fermentation's finally done?
Oh, you just guess. No. So the worst indication, visually, you'll see certain signs that show you that fermentation's done. You will see less sediment or less croissant on top of there. You'll see less movement, and you'll see if you're using a traditional airlock, you'll see less movement in there. But that by no means is a great way to say, oh, I'm done, time to cold crash. Because there still can be fermentation going on, and there can also be a lot of reabsorption and chemical reactions going on that you don't want to necessarily do that cold crash right away. To know if your fermentation is done from a eating of sugars, the best thing you can do is measure your sugar level. So the cheapest and easiest way is a hydrometer. I don't know about easiest way, but cheapest way is using hydrometers. Which I assume you've done podcasts on. The next best way in my opinion is refractometers, because at this stage when fermentation's done, I don't want to take a whole bunch of samples out. I want to take little tiny amounts out to test as opposed to big volumes of liquid. And so a refractometer, when used properly, can be used to know, is my fermentation done or not? And then there's a new product on the market. We'll be releasing it next week. We did not design it. Someone else did and manufactures it, but we're going to be distributing it for them. It's called the Beer Bug. And they did a Kickstarter, and so there's some out in population, and people love it. It's something that you put it onto your fermentation vessel. It has they call it a torpedo, but basically a device that is in your fermentation connected by a monofilament string that goes to the unit, and it is taking a reading. I believe it's every 3 minutes it turns on, takes a reading of both your density of sugars, just like a refractometer or a hydrometer would do. And it sends that to the cloud. And then you have logins and you can see. So you can see charts of your fermentation. Well, they also have an optional temp sensor you can do. So you can get a fully graphed out fermentation every time of your gravities, how long they took, your temperatures during that process, and exact measurements of what your original, what your final gravity, and every 3 minutes in between, which is really cool to be able to share. You can, they have social feeds for Facebook and other places if you're into that, or to just be able to track your fermentations, especially for what went well, what went wrong. Am I safe to do my diacetyl rest? Yes or no? Really, it's an exciting product that I think will really give you a lot of control of the fermentation process. And up to now, fermentation for most people is kind of like this process that happens in between boiling and drinking. And so there's a lot of time and a lot of science that goes on in that time frame. And I think this will help people understand that a lot better.
Very cool. How long can you store the beer in the fermenter before you have to move it?
You know, you're in a safety zone if you're under 3 weeks, in my opinion. That's, you know, the 20-something day, I think you're fine. I've seen people go even longer with not doing any racking or anything like that and still bottle their beer, still have good carbonated beer. I wouldn't go longer, but you can. So if something comes up, you're not able to get to it, don't throw that beer away. Don't panic. Still bottle it. If you're 4 months and something weird's growing on there, absolutely toss it. In fact, toss anything. Plastic that's in contact with it, but unless you're making sours. But you know, for your typical ales, 3 to 4 weeks is the max I would go before bottling or kegging. You can do secondaries, and when you go into a secondary, you want to go into something that reduces your headspace. So you'd go, say, a 6.5 gallon carboy into a 5, so that you don't have all this oxygen sitting on top of the wort. So that helps you be able to age it. Keep this in mind: certain types of beer and wine will intentionally let that beer or wine sit in those for over a year. Sometimes even longer. So it's not like, oh, I can't do that. You just have to be prepared and know what you're doing to be able to store it in there for long periods of time. But typically 10 to 14 days is your perfect amount of time on most ales. You can go up to 3 to 4 weeks, but I would try not to.
So do you have any closing tips on fermentation, Chris?
Temperature is key. I can't stress that enough. You got to be sanitary. So the one thing I didn't introduce, but there are actually a few more fermentation vessels that we really haven't talked about yet, mm-hmm. that are kind of, I consider, new to the market. So I'll actually step back for a second and say, like, I started brewing over 20 years ago. I actually read a book, and that this book is no longer in print, thank goodness. They talked about going to your local bakery, finding buckets that they use and throw away. And I did that. And it was like raspberry flavoring or something like that. You're never going to get rid of those smells. So using used plastic is a bad idea. And no people have done it, including this guy here, but with very limited good results, mostly bad results. So that's one thing. Fashioning your own is actually pretty commonly done. Repurposing old vessels that are stainless are done all the time. Kegs, I'll do my public service announcement. If you pay a deposit on a keg, you have not obtained a legally keg to alter and use yourself. You don't own it. So if you paid a deposit, you got to get that keg back. The breweries own those kegs.
I've heard of some people cutting the tops off them and using them.
Oh, yes. You can do that. The best is to talk to a brewery. Ask them, do you have any kegs that are no longer in service? They're not holding pressure. The splines, you know, the parts that make it the keg for serving are broken. Most breweries have a few of them in the back that they are going to salvage or whatnot, and they're happy to sell those to homebrewers on pennies on the dollar. And they're happy that you got one intended for this process, as opposed to taking one of their good working ones that cost them hundreds of dollars because you paid $20 for a deposit on. So that's one way to fashion one. I've seen people go to scrap yards. Randy Mosier, great guy. You'll see lots of books produced by him.
We had Randy on a couple weeks back.
Did he do his buck a pound?
No, I don't think he did a buck a pound.
Okay, someday you got to have him do a buck a pound. So he built his whole brewery around the concept of a buck a pound, which used to be most salvage yards charged about $1 a pound for what you bought there. Bought a pump, it weighed 2 pounds. Okay, that's $2. You bought all this sheet metal. Okay, it weighs 3 pounds. That's $3. Like, so he built his entire brew house that way. And he's fashioned his own fermenters and things like that. So, you know, using old soup kitchen supplies and whatnot. And nowadays, there's different options coming in. There's these plastic fermenters. This company out of Germany called Spiedel makes these tanks that are hugely popular. They're inexpensive. They're big. They usually have large openings, easy to clean. And so those have become very popular.
Yeah, I think I'm running an ad for, I think it's Fast Ferment.
Got it.
Also has a nice plastic conical.
Exactly. I think that's the V vessel of years ago, remolded and done really well. And I'm going to be looking at those guys as well, carrying their products. Blickman has come out with a beautiful line of stainless conicals.
Well, Blickman makes amazing stuff.
We've made stainless conicals. We did it first, by the way. But I love Blickman as well. We make ones that are temp controlled. So they have the built-in temp control for them. Then there's this other company and a few of them coming out there, but SS Brewtech is doing a fantastic job of making inexpensive conicals and something they made kind of a new category called the stainless brew bucket.
Here it is, right?
There you go. They're flying off the shelves because they're at a good price point for something that material wise will last pretty much forever. And they've done a nice little job of incorporating simple things like not really a conical bottom, but a drawn bottom so that your sediment is settling below where you'll draw the liquid out of. It's not great for reusing yeast, but great for doing separation when you're going to either bottle or keg your beer.
A nice price point too, you know.
I was going to say a very nice price point. What I was very impressed with was their conicals. They call them chronicles. They have very good price points as well. They are made overseas as opposed to the Blickman product and the Moorbeer conicals, which are made here in the States, but they make them at quite a nice price point.
There we go. I'm putting the other one here.
So they make.
There's a conical.
And what's the price point on the 7 on that? Under 400.
$3.95 for a 7-gallon stainless steel conical.
They also make like a 14 or 15 gallon at like $5.95, which is just a price point that's unheard of in the homebrewing industry. So they've done a nice job of getting these products to market. And so are a lot of other people right now. There's a lot of great fermentation products coming to the market at reasonable prices. These types of products are going to last you years. If you accidentally...
Yeah, stainless does not wear out, so...
And it handles, if you accidentally get a sour bug in or whatnot, you don't have to worry about, oh my God, I got to throw that away. With plastic, you kind of have to make that consideration because you're not going to probably be able to get rid of it.
Well, Chris, I wanted you to take just a minute or two, talk about what's going on at Moorbeer.
Well, we're expanding product lines like we just talked about constantly. We've like doubled our grain selection, tripled our hop selection. I don't know if there's any...
Of course, you're shipping from both coasts now, so that's great.
We ship for free over $59. We ship from both coasts. Our mantra is fast and free. We're doing our best to just get you your orders quick, usually shipping out the same day you order them, getting to you from one of our two coasts and two days or less on average, so that you can be brewing right away. And we're just upping our selections, and we carry everything from A to Z, from beginning brewing, all the yeast types available, all to the highest end brewing. We not only carry our own custom made brew sculptures, but we carry other people's as well.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate you coming on the show today and talking to us about fermentation.
Well, appreciate it, Brad. You have a good one.
Again, today, my guest was Mr. Chris Graham. He is the president of Moorbeer and Moor Flavor Inc. at moorbeer.com. He teaches brewing at the world-renowned Seibel Institute. And we've had Chris on the show 3 times before. I encourage you to check out, especially the one we did on kegging, podcast number 79. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, a big thank you to Chris Graham for joining us today. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, now offering 6 issues a year. Get your subscription now at the 4-issue price and get an additional 20% off when you use the offer code Beersmith at beerandbrewing.com. Again, use the offer code Beersmith at beerandbrewing.com. Also, check out the new How to Brew video series that I did with John Palmer. We've got How to Brew Malt Extract and How to Brew All Grain. It will be available very shortly. You can find out about both of those at beersmith.com/DVD. Again, that's beersmith.com/DVD. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.